Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Larry S. Sherman. He is a professor of neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University. He's been lecturing on the neuroscience of music for more than a decade. And Dennis Plies. He was for many years a music professor at Warner Pacific University, and he's also recorded albums and genres including gospel, classical, and jazz. And we're talking about the book they just co-authored, Every Brain Needs Music, The Neuroscience of Making and Listening to Music. Larry, Dennis, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm going to say this right now. This is one of these wild science books that's both really in-depth science. Like, you get a complete intro to neuroanatomy in this book. It's useful information, I mean, about teaching music. And it was also a load of frickin' fun. And so, congratulations to both of you. How did you two meet to put this book together?
Well, it started, I've been giving talks about music in the brain for years. And funny enough, I play racquetball three times a week in this gym here in Portland, Oregon. And one morning, it was right after one of my talks, and my racquetball partner asked me how the talk went the night before. And Dennis happened to be standing there in the locker room at the same time and said, "Did you say that you give a talk about music in the brain?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, my gosh, I've been to your talk twice. I just didn't recognize you because you didn't have any clothes on." And
Oh my God. Now there's an opening line.
That's how our relationship started. So what was funny was, you know, after that we'd have these long discussions about music and history and philosophy, and we just realized we had a lot in common and complemented each other's interests in the area of music. And to the annoyance of my racquetball partners, every morning we'd see each other, we'd talk for, you know, 10, 15 minutes, and they're like, "Come on, Larry, it's time to play racquetball." But we hit it off right away. Dennis, I think you and I feel the same way about this, right? I mean,
it's very natural. Yes.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing is it comes off in the writing. And so it's really fascinating. And like I said, this is a fascinating book from the word go, because you deeply believe, and I want to make sure it's both of you, that the brain cannot live without music. Do you believe that?
I mean, as a neuroscientist, you know, I feel strongly that early exposure to music is critical to really having a healthy brain, and continuing to engage in music throughout life can maintain that health or even enhance it. So I do feel that it's one of those things that you know, I get angry whenever I hear about them trying to cancel music programs in school.
Oh, yeah.
Because what the music does for our brains is pretty remarkable.
Dennis?
I would say, I wouldn't say absolutely it the brain cannot live without it, because there are a few people that really detest music. But any involvement in music, listening, and specifically or particularly learning to play an instrument because of the hands and digits being used and all the coordination, is magnificent, helpful brain health.
And that's one of the things that was one of the major takeaways from this book, is that learning to play music physically changes your brain.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah, and it does so in ways that when I first started putting this talk together many years ago, I was surprised how much overlap it has with the research I do in my laboratory at the Oregon Health Sciences University, because it actually does do things like drive the formation of new circuits in the brain in ways that are very, a lot of things we do with learning do that, but music does it to the next degree. And then, for example, I study a substance called myelin.
Mm.
myelin is something that if you have it and you're a nerve cell, it's like driving on the Autobahn at midnight. You can be going 200 miles an hour and no one's going to bother you. And if you don't have myelin, it's like pick your worst highway at rush hour, right? And think about driving maybe 2 miles an hour. And that's really the difference in speed. And music, it turns out, can help generate new myelin and improve myelination. So this is really, to me, just fascinating that we actually structurally change our brains when we engage in music.
Now, for the benefit of the audience, I want to say that this is a serious neurology book. And so there's lots of diagrams of brain anatomy throughout the book done by Susie Davis, which I found really helpful because I wanted to know. But thank God the fMRI has been invented, because there's been so many research, so much research on where the brain, how the brain is being affected by listening to music. However, I do want to say, and you do mention this in the book, the person is in an fMRI machine, which I've been in one, and it's not really great being in one of those machines.
No, there's one,
you're asking people to compose music and stuff like that. I love that the fact that you had the gumption to ask a person in one of those machines to do tasks like that.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. There's the one study we talk about. It's a bunch of Swedish pianists.
Yes!
They all have the exact same backgrounds, the exact same degrees. But here they are laying down on their backs, with their heads in this tiny space, with a keyboard in their lap, and they're biting down on a bar to keep their head still. I mean, how, I know when I compose, that's exactly how I want to be.
Dennis, I mean, you compose music. What did you think of those experiments where the people were in those conditions? Seems like some kind of torture.
What I've learned through these studies is that when we even think about an act that we physically are not doing, our brain is being engaged in a similar, if not exacting, way.
So the brain is acting as if we're doing it.
Yes.
Wow. Now, there's a quote from Frank Zappa, who I, by the way, got the chance to see when I was at college. And it was the best concert I've ever been to. He was there with the complete Mothers of Invention, and it was fantastic.
Yeah. But he said, I wish I'd been there.
Oh, it was in the Clark Women's Gym. It was amazing. He defined a composer as a guy who goes around forcing his will on unsuspecting air molecules, often with the assistance of unsuspecting musicians.
Yep.
Having seen them play, that's exactly correct in his case. But you actually try at one point in this book, in the beginning, to define what music is. Is it easy to define?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the standpoint of what we're talking about, I mean, Dennis and I went back and forth on this many times. We there's all these great poetic ideas. There's this quote, that music is organized sound.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, I think Frank had it right. when we think about what sound is from the level of physics, it's these air molecules that are vibrating a certain way. And when music is being created from some source, it's causing these changes in these air molecules that are then coming into the ear. And that's the perceiver, the beginning of the perceiver anyway. And from that point on, it's all about taking that information and turning it into what we call music. So, if the human brain isn't there to hear that, is it music? That's a philosophical question, but
wow.
I would argue no. I would argue no, because animals can, for example, animals can perceive different aspects of music, the pitch and timbre and all these other things, and rhythm. But putting it all together the way our brain does, only our brain can do that, and that's remarkable to me. And when we think about how rich of an information system music is, it kind of makes sense. You need a complicated brain with a certain level of this frontal cortex that we have that can take that information coming from the ears and turning it into mm-hmm. what we mostly love. So
one finding you mentioned in the beginning of the book is that music, but not other sounds, activate specific areas of the auditory cortex in both hemispheres.
Yeah.
That was one of the, it's funny, when I was talking to people about this book, one of the first things they asked is, Well, so is it all on one side of the brain?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I think if you look at the areas that are activated, anything you do with engaging in music activates places all over the brain on both sides. And the finding that there's actually music-specific neurons just still blows me away. I mean, and it's a chicken and the egg thing, right? Were those cells there just waiting to hear music? Or did they come into being when we were young and starting to experience music? And that's still an unanswered question.
Well, one of the things about the beginning part of the book, just literally the first couple of chapters, is you start talking about the evolution of humans and music. And I felt like there could have been a whole book there. I mean, there's a belief that the human brains actually evolved to engage in music. And that some people have suggested that people communicated before language with musical sounds or stuff played on ancient instruments like flutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You say absolutely, but that's a huge deal.
It is a huge deal, but it makes sense. You think about what music does in terms of promoting senses of community, acceptance within a group, all the neurochemistry that happens when you engage with music. It's an adaptive response. I mean, that helps the human being, you know, continue to exist. So it's an adaptive response, and even Darwin acknowledged that as a possibility. So I think it totally makes sense to me. I mean, Dennis and I went back and forth about this many times, and I think we both kind of feel in our hearts that that's just, it makes total sense.
And we were talking about flutes as an ancient instrument. There are prehistoric flutes that have been found that are 40,000 years old.
Yeah, and not just Homo sapien flutes. A possible Neanderthal flute as well, which tells you that our cousins, who, you know, we share some DNA with because we mated with them, were making music the same time we started making music.
Now, shortly after that little chapter, which immediately engaged me, you started talking about composing music versus improvising music. And the findings that have come out about those two forms of dealing with music, for me, were startling and things I didn't even think about. Essentially, they're two very different creative processes within the brain.
I think Dennis, as a musician who's both in the classical and jazz expertise, can talk about those processes better than I can.
Dennis, when you're improvising music, can you actually sense that you're in a different state?
Well, it's attempting to not be aware in the same way of composing. So learning about improvisation and realizing that it really means not thinking is quite a factor, because almost everything in life should be thinking. That what we're doing right now, it's called conversation, and we're thinking, but we're also letting go.
Right.
We don't know what, unless this is a political agenda, we don't have, or selling a car, we don't have a plan. We're just exploring together. And that's what's happening when you can prepare for improvisation through, you have to have the vocabulary and patterns and such, but then it's a letting go if you're really improvising. I taught a woman who has a doctorate in music, and I don't think she ever, after the 2 years of lessons, ever realized what improvisation was, because she would stop and say, "Oh, that's not what I wanted to do." Well, that you can't have a want. You might have a desire, but you are you're finding out what you're doing. It's like free writing. You find out what you're thinking and feeling by just letting the pen go.
Can you teach improvisation?
I do it all the time. I love teaching improvisation, and I realize that sometimes it's 8 weeks or 8 months of just getting past the psychological barrier, and other people, they're ready to go. They're not trying to please. themselves or others, and they're free. And so a lot of it is psychological, but as you can make small the exercises. If a person's really uptight, they can take two different sounds and do something with them playfully.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Larry S. Sherman, professor of neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University. He's been lecturing on the neuroscience of music for more than a decade. And Dennis Plies, who for many years was a music professor at Warner Pacific University, and he's actually recorded albums in genres like gospel, classical, and jazz. And together they've written, I think, one of the most entertaining and fascinating books about the brain and music. Every Brain Needs Music: The Neuroscience of Making and Listening to Music. Larry, one of the findings in this difference between improvisation and composition was that when people are improvising, parts of the brain are deactivated.
Yeah.
That was a surprise to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. So when you look at the studies on what's happening when you're composing, and from what Dennis was just talking about, I mean, composing is not just being free and letting go. Composing, you're planning,
right.
You're editing,
yeah.
you're trying to do something that's going to last. And so when you look at the brains of people who are composing, you're activating a lot of different areas involved in planning, involved in memories for specific patterns, parts of your auditory cortex, of course, when you're trying to imagine what it is you're trying to generate. When you're looking at the improvising brain, and these studies have mostly been done with jazz musicians who are the best improvisers out there, it's actually deactivating some of those same areas as well as other areas. And it's almost like you're breaking down the rules and expectation centers of your brain. You're letting things go so that you can be free and just, color outside the box, basically, right? So, and that's really what's happening when you're improvising. So it makes sense in a way.
It seems like you're deactivating areas so that you can let go.
Exactly.
And that's what
actually there's a type of analysis that people are doing now. It's called network analysis, where you're actually looking at networks of neurons between different areas of the brain. And what's remarkable is when you are in that state of improvising, those networks break down. And so a lot of those neurons are inhibitory neurons. They're actually turning things off. Some of them are excitatory too, but you're basically shutting down those confining networks and being free to just kind of create in the moment.
Are there neurological differences between playing solo and playing in a group?
There are some, actually. And the most remarkable thing about that was that when you look at people who are doing something called trading fours, where it's a planned improvisation, right? So you play four bars, and then I'm going to play four bars in response to those four bars. But it's a musical conversation, right, at that point. And so when you look at some of the areas being activated when that's happening, language centers in the brain light up. It's almost like you're starting to treat this musical conversation as a linguistic conversation. And that's also fascinating.
There's a really interesting study that you write about in the book with Gordon Matthew Thomas Sumner, better known as Sting. I can't believe that he submitted to having experiments done on him.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's great. And again, you always have to take studies like a sample size of one with a grain of salt.
Yeah, but it was all because he was obviously a huge name. And that was fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And he's also...
So, wait a minute. Did he get stuck in an fMRI machine?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and they asked him to do a lot of crazy things, including listening to just different genres of music and to imagine different genres of music.
Yeah,
and that was pretty cool because it turns out that different genres actually did show different kinds of patterns of activity.
Wow.
Then that could have been partly because of his musical preferences, but it also might have been partly because of just how the complexity of the music or the patterns of the music and how that moves people. There's a lot, there's so much happening there because you have an emotional response to the music you are listening to and the music you're making. You have an intellectual response that's different and everything. And of course, the patterns are different. So,
well, and this reminds me, reading this book, every finding seemed to raise new questions that need further study.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's the coolest thing about the field right now is we've gone from knowing very little to a little. And what little we've learned is so compelling because it opens up big questions. Like, I mean, if you'd asked somebody 25 years ago about the value of music therapy, most people would look at you like you were crazy. Yeah. And now we know that, you know, music therapy is incredibly effective for people with a lot of different brain injuries. I mean, my favorite example is Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords.
Right.
She was shot in the head. You know, she lost the ability to initiate speech, but it turns out she could still sing. And she went through a long period of music therapy that actually helped her get back to being able to speak. And she speaks beautifully now. But what's remarkable is when you look at what was happening in the brain, you're basically rewiring the brain through music.
Wow.
And allowing it to get around those areas of damage to become a functional brain again. And that to me is just fascinating.
I want to talk, and we're going to run out of time. I want to talk about practicing music. There's a great chapter on learning to play and the differences between an adult and a young person learning to play an instrument. Dennis, are there real differences, like if an adult of like 50 or 60 wants to learn an instrument versus a young person?
The general approach, adult pedagogy is different. I just have witnessed it tens of times, and children are ready to, they walk in the studio and they can't wait to play. They don't want to talk about music. Adults walk in and they want to tell me all about for 10 minutes, they'll sit there and tell me about their week. And a lot of it is, of course, defensive talking of why I couldn't practice or why I couldn't do this and all that.
Yeah.
But they love to talk about it, and they're a little fearful about doing it. In contrast to children who they don't want to talk about it, they just want to do. Their fingers are ready to go. They're tactile and
now, haptics. You write that it's important that people have no heavy expectations of immediate success, especially if they're adults.
Especially, yes. And I've witnessed that in myself in wanting to learn a couple of other instruments, bass, clarinet, and flute. And after three lessons on each, I realized I know how to produce a beautiful tone quality on various other instruments, and I don't have the patience and that was when I was even 30, and I'm quite a bit older now. It's just a general trait that we have high expectations because we're really, as adults, into time. And children, they haven't figured out time yet. They're playful.
Now, and I love that you talk about the importance of grit. What is grit?
Oh, yeah.
What is grit?
Yeah, so grit is a personality trait. There's been a lot of studies done on it, but it's basically this combination of passion and perseverance and a lot of other things that kind of come together that let you kind of stick it out. And so it's not the only thing, but it does help. And people who have high levels of grit will tend to, I mean, Dennis is an example there.
Yeah.
You know, if you're trying to learn a new instrument and you're just, it's hard, you know, it's really hard. If you have that sense of passion and perseverance together, they come together to really produce a good music student. So, yeah, we talk a lot in the book about, you know, what makes a good music teacher, but we also talk about what makes a good music student.
Well, you also write that the student has to be curious.
Absolutely. And curiosity is so important for every aspect of music. We talk about it is important for when you're composing music, but also when you're learning music and being willing to experiment and look for patterns and ways to be better at what you do. It makes a big difference.
Now, you write about how our brain processes pleasurable experiences, liking and wanting. How does that pertain to practicing music?
Yeah, so anything we do in life, you know, part of the motivating factor is if it's something that we really enjoy doing. And so if you come down and you sit down at a piano and you start to kind of fool around and you realize you're making these pleasing sounds that you're kind of cool, getting some excitement from, that leads to this liking response in the brain. And when you like something, that immediately gives you the reward of wanting it. So you want something because you like it. It's like you eat a piece of chocolate, you like it, you want more chocolate. Same thing with music. And so the wanting response is run mostly by this neurotransmitter dopamine, but there's other aspects of it too. And then you go back to doing it again, and you like it again until you get bored with it, and then everything gets shut down. But that's a huge part of just the drive for motivation.
Throughout that chapter, you talk about the importance of the student-teacher relationship. Now, you've done a series of surveys with musicians and with people who listen to music, and that's in an appendix at the end of the book. There was a lot of interesting information in that appendix from these people who were surveyed. A number of people had bad experiences learning to try to play an instrument.
There are some tragically formulaic teachers out there who might mean well, but they think of shaming as a way of motivating.
Right, right.
And it's unbelievable how I just began a 60-year-old woman a month ago, and after the first lesson, and she had never had any lessons on any musical instrument. She was thumbing through the other pages and said, "Oh, these sharps and flats, they scare me." And I said, "Might you consider the opposite, the antidote to the fear, as curiosity? Like, what are these?
Yeah, yeah.
Little buggers." And she's now on a new course of positivity.
Oh, wow.
But the relationship is healthy, too. And then I think that is so significant that when your teacher cares for you, I took many lessons as a 6 and 7 and 8 year old, and almost all of them I came out crying. And that's totally unnecessary. I took lessons from great teachers later in life and couldn't wait to get home to practice.
We're completely out of time, and we're going to have both of you back because there's so much more to talk about in this book. My guests tonight are Larry S. Sherman, professor of neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University. He's been lecturing on the neuroscience of music for more than a decade. And Dennis Plies, who for many years was a music professor at Warner Pacific University. You can sort of hear that he's the guy that you want to learn music from. He's recorded albums also in genres including gospel, classical music, and jazz. And together, they've written a wonderful book called Every Brain Needs Music, The Neuroscience of Making and Listening to Music. Dennis and Larry, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.